Yeah, it seems I made a mistake about describing that Damon Woods had gone to England. He had not. He had been promoted and was now chief interior designer. Well, anyway, back to the Mustang project. We got a wood armature and everything set up and piled the clay on it and started the designers on making sketches of what we might do. Of course, we had photographs available to us of the previous models that had been developed in the advanced studio, so we knew what not to do. I wouldn't want to say that those vehicles were poor looking, because they weren't. They were all kind of different, although they seemed to have a main theme running through them. But we well understood that there were, and we all understood that that model might still be approved if we didn't come up with an alternative that found favor with management. I did some sketching myself at home the first few nights while the clay was getting shaped up and carved down into the general package, and then we all got together and settled on the design elements that are mainly evident in the car as it stands today. The long body side scoop terminating in the quarter panel and the triple element tail lamps and the mouthy front end. Of course, at this time the car was called Cougar.
Early code name, wasn't it?
Not Mustang. Well, I don't know whether it was a code name or whether it was serious, but it was a Cougar. And as you can see in these photographs of the early Mustang models, it had a cat regardant in it. It also had an eagle at one time, I see, and a Ford crest.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a cat going the other direction. So it had a number of different symbols and names for a while. Anyway, at the end of beginning of the next week, the model was pretty well along the way, and I wouldn't say it was complete, but all the elements were there.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe came back from his training session and lined us all up, and as if the model never sat there on the floor, it was telling us how we were going to go about designing it, you know, by using the new Kepner-Trigo analysis method.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about the end of the previous week, the first week that we had to design it, Iacocca had been in, and he liked it. Even in the rough state that it was, he has a great eye for perceiving things. So I kind of let Joe know that, you know, the thing was in high favor, as it was. Well, I guess he usually didn't like doing this kind of thing. He wanted his thumbprint on everything, and I guess he got his thumb on this eventually. I think he wound up putting a better looking what we call a C-pillar on the car than the one we had. The one I had was more stiff and formal, and he gave it a little more slope and rounded a little bit, which I think sat better on the car. By the way, the model had two different sides to it.
Oh.
Yeah, only one side had this long side scoop theme on it. The other side was totally different.
Hmm.
This was done frequently. It gives you two looks at a single clay model. I mean, you can only see one side at once, so it's like making two separate clay models.
What was your input into this final model?
I would say substantial.
Mm-hmm.
However, anyone that says they designed the car by themselves is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Iacocca didn't design it. He conceived it. I mean, he's called the father of it, and I suppose in that respect he was. I did not design it in total, nor did Oris. It was designed by a design group. If you look at the photograph taken at the awards banquet for the Industrial Designers Society, where the Mustang received the medal. It's got Damon Woods in it, who group did the interior, and Charlie Faniff, I guess, who was with Damon. And it's got myself and John Foster, who was with me. It's got Nager in it. I'm not sure what Nager was involved in, but he had some involvement with it.
Something to do with the name, perhaps.
I don't know. And, of course, Bournet and Oris. So nobody actually did the car as such. Now, Iacocca, in his book, flat out comes and says, I did the car. I mean, it's right there in print. It's Dave Ash's Mustang. Bournet will tell you I did the car. This book tells you I did the car. But in actual fact, I had a lot of help, you know, and I don't think anyone ever does a car by himself, not in these times anyway. But it was a huge success. It, I mean, it was a hands-down winner when we had the beauty contest shortly thereafter. I mean, there was no, it was no contest, really. It was the right car. And it went through the engineering system very rapidly and had a spectacular introduction and was a tremendous sales success. I think it did me a great deal of good personally. I think it stuck in Iacocca's mind that I probably was the major contributor to the car and designing it or helping design it and, you know, bringing it along. Because shortly thereafter, I received a major promotion. Oh, wait, I got to backtrack a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. There's a little cloak and dagger story involved in how it got its final name. Once again, I was out of the Ford studio and back in what was called the corporate project studio with McGuire again. Now the car, the Mustang, was of course in the Ford studio, by now a fiberglass replica and all spiffied up, painted vermilion and poppy red. And it had lettering on it that said Cougar. It had a cat in its front end and everything, and the interior, the seat buttons had Cougars on them and so forth. The instrument panel, I think, said Cougar, and everything was going into tooling this way. So I was in a corporate project studio, and at that time I was working on with race car people the first GT40 Le Mans car. It really wasn't a styling or a design project. It was pretty aerodynamically controlled, but it was fun, you know, to work on a real flat out Le Mans race car. And Nager, who I think was in the studio at the same time, was working on a show model of what we eventually became Mustang. There's pictures of it in here. I want to switch that off for a second. So there was a show model being developed in the corporate project studio, which I'm pretty sure Nager was in charge of. The idea being that it looked a great deal like what the production Cougar was going to look like, and that the production car coming out hard on the heels of the show model would get very good rub off from the show model. So as far as I can recall, this show model was being done by Nager and McGuire. And one day, as I was going about my business, Bournet and Iacocca came into the studio and took me aside into my little office, I guess it was, and in effect swore me to secrecy on pain of death and dismemberment and whatever, and told me that I was to work with Nager on this thing to the extent that I was to change its symbology and its name to Mustang. And I was given authority to find out where the tooling had gone on Cougar script being cast in metal and Cougar lines or Cougars in the interior and elsewhere, which I did. I didn't tell any engineers to stop tooling because I didn't have that authority. Besides, I was sworn to secrecy. Anyway, I went to the Ford studio and I looked over the model and I made notes of where I found Cougars or Cougar lettering anywhere. And Major and I then went about the business of having one of our fine clay modelers sculpture this horse. Mm-hmm. And we designed this little emblem and we changed the buttons on the seats and anywhere there was Cougar elements, they were changed to Mustang lettering or the Mustang symbology.
Who did the first sculpture of the horse, do you remember?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of his name. It's a Hungarian guy. Karastish. What was his first name? Carl? Oh, that's not right. Last name is Karastish. Mm-hmm.
K-A-R.
K-A-R-E-S-T-E-S, something like that. Mm-hmm. Hungarian. Mm-hmm. Very fine guy, very fine modeler, mm-hmm. sculptor.
And was it his final design that you all approved?
Yes, yes.
The Mustang?
Sculptured in clay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it turned out to be an enduring...
And then I got a lot of flack. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself again. Anyway, I had to make sure that everything that we did was not just something that was going to be made one of for a show car. It had to be exactly what was going on the production car and had a fit in those places.
Mm.
Which it did, all right. So at a given signal, I don't know what it was, all of a sudden the Cougar stopped being a Cougar and a Mustang came in. But I couldn't tell Joe Orris this and I couldn't tell Damon Woods this, you know.
Sworn to secrecy.
I was sworn to secrecy, so under Cloak and Dagger, I changed the name around, so on.
Must have caused some consternation and
yes,
surprise.
Yes, it did. Well, I think Damon sort of chuckled at it. I think Joe was a little discombobulated about it, as he might have been, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that all got done and happened. Let's see, where was I on that? Backtracking there. Changing the Mustang name. Oh yeah, the Mustang hardtop. Well, that I guess I didn't really have anything to do about because that was done subsequently in the Ford studio, which I was no longer in.
Well, the Mustang was a great success, as you mentioned. And,
it certainly was.
And your career was certainly solidified.
Yeah, in fact, it took a dramatic leap upward.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Well, it was my major promotion. It wasn't too long after the Mustang, and I was in the corporate project studio that I got summoned into Bourdonnais' office, and as you have observed, he likes to talk. And he gave me a long, lengthy, rambling account of how Iacocca liked to have competitive proposals put before him from not just one design group, from a number, like the Mustang project. And he said, the way we're set up now, he said, we've got some of that. And he gave me an example. He said, for instance, if there's a Ford project going on that the Ford studio has, the Advanced studio will frequently do a competitive version of it. And he said, we call that chocolate, vanilla and chocolate. But he says, Lee wants a third group to involve in this competitive action, and he wants what he calls his strawberry studio. Then he got to the point, he says, you're going to be in charge of that. Now what this does is elevate me to the rank of chief stylist, which is a very good place to be, is right under vice president.
So you were co-equal with Joe Orris?
I don't work for McGuire or Orris or Nager or anybody except Bourdain now. Good. And Iacocca, as it turns out.
Right.
So I said, well, that's just fine. I said, where am I going to be? And I said, what's my staff? He says, oh, he says, there's been a lot of work done on that already. He said, you're not going to be just put out in the hall and told to find a place. He says, you're going to be in the basement for a while. There's a lot of storage area down in the basement. A lot of it was vacant. That was all right with me because it kind of got me out of the way and I wouldn't have a lot of people traipsing in and out, I thought. It didn't work out that way. I said, what's the name of this studio? He says, I don't know. He says, why don't you name it? Okay. So later on, incidentally, this is a real fine promotion.
Mm-hmm.
This puts you on what's called an E-roll, a company executive role. You get a company car, a couple of them every year, and at least two cars, and an enormous boost in salary and bonus and all that. So it's a real major thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just delighted with it. Later on that day, I was meeting with Bill Corrigan, the personnel manager, to line up who was going to be on my staff.
Mm-hmm.
Designers, clay modelers, administrative people, secretary, and so forth, and whatnot. I also got a private office up in the front row there, and a private secretary went with the job. Real nice stuff. So I said, where do I get the people? Well, he says, sort of like an expansion team in a football league. They come, you know, a few from here and a few from there. He says, all the other studios have to give up some designers and clay modelers to staff you. He said, they'll get replaced, you know, out of art schools and whatnot, but for the time being, you're going to be staffed by, you know, people that come out of there. He says, oh, they'll probably give me the dregs. Oh, no, he said, they had had meetings with the other chief stylists before I had been promoted, and all this had been settled, you know, except for my two key people. I was to get two executive stylists.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do any interior work in this studio, but I had sort of a Ford side and a Lincoln Mercury side. That's the way I divided it up. And I was supposed to get two executive stylists.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them came from the Edsel thing. This is Ken Spencer.
Oh, yeah.
He'd had some assignments since then, but he seemed to be very happy to have a place sort of like home. And the other one was unknown. He was to be hired.
Uh-huh.
And Gene got back to me and he said, the first thing you got to do is meet with John Reinhardt and try to convince him to come back and be your other executive stylist.
And at this point, he's where?
He's nowhere. His job had folded up at U.S. Steel. He was sort of in limbo.
It was about 1962,
probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess 60. No, it wouldn't. It would have been 64 because that's when I got the job.
Okay.
It was in 64.
Right.
I said, well, do I have any choice? No, he says, not unless John turns the job down. See, John endeared himself very deeply to Bill Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Ford was over Bourdain, and so I gather that it was kind of force-fed that we should hire John if John wanted the job.
Mm-hmm.
So I arranged to meet John at the Dearborn Inn for breakfast the next morning.
He was back in town by then.
Yeah, well, I guess so. I guess he was supposed to be because he knew he was getting interviewed for a job.
Of course, yes.
Back at Ford. So I laid it out to him just absolutely truthful. I said, I told him what the job was. I told him it's down in the basement. I said, it's a brand new studio. We're going to have a lot of fun, a lot of challenging work, and very competitive. I said, that's our whole job, is competition with the other studios. I told him who was working with us, stylists and the clay modelers and whatnot. And seemed very, have you met John yet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, John's a great guy. He's very slow. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything he does is slow motion. He's a good designer, but the earlier contacts with him were, he just had a terrible time keeping up with the pace of. Now, in the Continental Division, it was different. He had one car to do and nothing else.
Yeah.
He did fine there. I guess what he molded over, and I guess he obviously decided he didn't want to get back into our rat race, because he called not me, but Gene the next morning and said, thanks, but no thanks. So I went back to Corrigan and I said, well, I got a turn down from Reinhardt. I said, who's the next candidate? Well, he said, we got a call from a guy by the name of Kopka over at Chrysler, who is not too happy working for Elwood Engel, and would like to come with us. I so happened I knew Kopka. I knew him very briefly. He and I had been co-speakers at an SAE function, he from Chrysler at the time and me from Ford, so I'd met him. I didn't know anything about him as far as his qualifications were concerned. He seemed to be a very personable chap, but that's all I knew about him. Well, I was told he's supposed to be a very, very hotshot guy. I said, you're going to intend to bring him in as an executive stylist? He says, that's the only thing he'd come in at. He was, I guess at that time, had done 57 DeSoto and some other rather memorable cars. And so I said, fine, bring him in. So Kopka came in. And boy, am I glad we got him. He was just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's the vice president now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was just great. He was a lot of fun to work with, and I mean, you couldn't ask for a better guy. Just great.
So he came in as your...
As my other executive. Now, what we did start with was the next generation of Mustangs, among other things. We also worked on Fords and Cougars and Thunderbirds. We got I forget what model of year it was. It was an all-new Thunderbird, and we were in a flat-out competitive race with the Ford Studio, Oris and Company, and won that one. We got a whole, an all-new Thunderbird and a Cougar.
What year was that? 50.
I'm trying to recall. No, it would have been 65. 65.
Yeah. 65, 67.
It was the one with a long sloping nose and a mouth on it,
in
the front end, sort of a gigantic Mustang in a way. And things went very well. I mean, we got a lot of approvals, much to the annoyance of Grissinger and Norris and so forth, but that's the way it went. And I got a lot more attention from Iacocca. He came down to that studio very often. Gene sort of let me know. He says, try to have something, good for Lee to look at. One time I did a Ford front end for 66 or whatever, and it was asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. In other words, it wasn't the same on both sides. It had a sort of a mouth-like effect with one headlamp in it, and the other side had like three more or something. It sounds terrible, but it looked pretty good in a spooky sort of way. And Lee came in, he stood in front of that, and he looked at it. He'd never seen it before, never seen anything like it before. He's trying to make up his mind whether it was any good or not, and he finally says, no, he says, that won't fly. He said, that's not right for the car. And I said, well, I don't think so either. In a way, it's not right for, you know, a family and the D-Ford. Maybe on something else sometime, a Thunderbird or whatever. And so that was the end of it. But he came down there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in Maine, he liked what he saw. It was, well, I guess, you know, it was one of his projects, really, to set up that studio, which, mm-hmm. incidentally, I named Special Development Studio.
Is that what the name is?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I named it because, mm-hmm. I was told to name it, and that's what I called it. Sort of a innocuous name, but I thought it took care of things all right.
How did that square with the Advance Studio? Who was Della Rosa, still doing that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself in competition occasionally?
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. yes, of course. Although not as much. We competed mainly with the Ford and the Lincoln Mercury Studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were Don Kopka's strengths, chiefly?
Well, everything you could imagine. He was a fine designer. He was a fine manager.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't anything that he couldn't do superlatively.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone liked him.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The girls thought he was a doll.
he's
still very
handsome.
Still a very good-looking man, even though he's 57, I guess, by mm-hmm. now. He seems to be ageless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was the problem with Chrysler? Did you ever hear?
No, but he just didn't like working for Elwood.
He got a little restive, huh?
Well, Elwood is a tough person to work for. He's mm-hmm. So is Joel.
This is Elwood Engel.
Elwood Engel, yeah. Yes.
They came up through the same matrix, huh?
Well, they came out of George Walker's
consulting firm.
Consulting firm,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them very good designers. Very good personalities. Although Elwood wasn't bad. He was just kind of dumb in a way, you know, as far as working with people. He was fine working by himself.
Yeah.
He was funny to be around. He was always joking and throwing clay balls. There's still clay balls up in the ceiling of the studios at work, I think. And pitching pennies, you know, work for him was play.
Mm-hmm.
He loved designing cars and working in the clay, and he liked throwing clay balls and pitching pennies, and it was all part of the same thing.
I guess he was having his problems administratively with Chrysler as well.
Well, I can imagine so, because of all the things that Elwood was, he was not a manager. When I was with Nager once, he came into my office with one of the designers who apparently had told Elwood that he, the designer, was unhappy, that he wasn't getting anywhere. So Elwood comes marching into my office with this designer and says, I've forgotten his name, hey, Joe here wants to be an executive designer. Why don't you fix him up? Really?
He was serious?
Yeah, he was serious. Another time, for some reason or other, he'd gotten a hold of all the envelopes with pay raises, notification of salary increases in them. And he walked around my studio with this bunch of envelopes. He says, okay, Bill, he says, you get one of these. He goes, nope, you don't get any. And he goes to the next guy and says, yeah, you get one. And, you know, he did this. Now, those should have come to me.
Yes.
And, of course, I would have, you know, called the guys individually into my office and told them this. Oh, well. Anyway, Kopka just did everything right. He eventually was transferred out of there, and he went to work for Damon Woods in the interior studio, and Damon couldn't find anything mm-hmm. wrong with him. He eventually succeeded Damon
mm-hmm.
as interior chief designer. So,
This is Dave Crippen, and this is Wednesday, April the 10th, 1985, and we are at the Archives Record Center talking with L. David Ash, one of the senior designers at Ford Motor Company from about 1950 to about 1980. And Mr. Ash will pick up his career from about, I think, about 1970, would you think? The mid-60s. In any event, Mr. Ash will tell his story in his own narrative.
Talking about probably in early late 1966 or early 67. And about this time came a project which Iacocca initiated and was carried forth exclusively in my the special project studio. At the outset, it was nameless, and it was set up rather loosely as a Thunderbird equivalent in the Lincoln Mercury lineup. That is, some special personal luxury car that would fit in between the Mercury Marquis and the Lincoln. Smaller than either one of them, but probably as expensive, or maybe not quite in the Lincoln price range, but more than a Mercury. And it was to be based on a Thunderbird as far as the general package and the chassis and so forth. Underneath the engine and drivetrain were all Thunderbird. And there was also to be quite a bit of interchangeability in the body panels, except for the front fenders and hood and the rear end. We got into this quite a way, and around then we became aware that Cadillac was about to introduce the Eldorado. And when I say we, it was the company, really. And the character of this project got switched around from a in between Mercury and Lincoln into a top-of-the-line model. In other words, it was going to wind up in the Lincoln lineup, but still in its guise as a Thunderbird derivative. One of the biggest problems we were having with the Clay model was the door, because the product plans called for use of the Thunderbird door, which had very definite characteristics stamped into it, which we were having a great deal of problem working with. And eventually it was recognized that this was a severe impediment to getting a distinctive looking car, so that requirement was removed. In other words, we could use unique outer door skin on this car, as long as it could be fastened suitably to a carryover Thunderbird door inner panel.
Was this done to save money, do you think?
Well, yes, any derivative car is done to save money. It's done to do two things: save time and money. Because when you don't have to develop an all new car from the ground up, as far as, you know, chassis engineering and all that sort of stuff is considered, you save time.
Yeah.
You also save money because you don't have to retool a lot of stuff. And in many cases, you can build two different cars on the same assembly line. Thunderbirds and what this turned out to be, for instance.
Yeah.
And it gets you into the marketplace sooner, and it gets you into the marketplace with less investment, which is all to the benefit. There was a rather brilliant product planner by the name of Hal Siegel on, who was working on this car with us.
How do you spell his last name?
S-E-I-G-E-L, I think. He eventually quit and went to American Motors. But he did some very interesting analysis, because at that time there was also a four-door Thunderbird, which had a longer wheelbase and more package room, more couple distance in it. And he did a very careful engineering analysis and found that, lo and behold, we could work off of the four-door Thunderbird platform, or chassis, if you want to call it that, and have a...
That's what platform means, chassis?
Yeah, not always. Platform usually refers to a unitized car. But talk about chassis and floor pan and so forth, all that stuff you don't see. And wind up with a longer car, a longer wheelbase, and more couple distance inside.
What do you mean by couple distance?
Couple distance is the distance between the front and the rear seat. The more couple distance you have, the more spacious the knee room, the leg room is when you're sitting in the rear.
C-O-U-P?
Couple, yeah, just...
E-L.
Couple distance. Mm-hmm. So we shifted gears a little bit. It wasn't any big deal. We just lengthened the wheelbase on the clay model and started over again. We were working at that time with themes that were pretty contemporary American luxury car themes, as far as the front, rear, and side view were concerned. And frankly, it didn't seem to be getting off the ground in the way that we thought it should, and Iacocca recognized this too. In fact, I have to give him full credit for inspiration of what the car eventually turned out to look like.
At this point, what is Iacocca's title?
Iacocca is, at this point, I don't know. He was certainly above vice president of the Ford division. I don't know whether he was
Car group vice president?
I couldn't really tell you that. I guess you might have to refer to his book or something else, but he was an overall vice president over all the car and truck divisions. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had anything to do with this Lincoln Mercury project.
Yeah.
In his book, he says he was in Canada in one night in a motel and couldn't sleep. He was thinking about this car. And he says he called Jean Bordenay. Well, as a matter of fact, he didn't. I guess he tried to, but Jean was in Europe. And he wound up talking to me. And he said, you know, Dave, I've been thinking about this. He says, why don't you try something like the old Continental rear end, you know, the spare tire effect, and maybe something classy, like a Rolls-Royce front end. I said, fine. In fact, after I finished talking to him, I thought, you know, we should have thought of that, but we didn't think that way then. If I'd put a Rolls-Royce front end on a car at that time, Bordenay would have chewed me up and down. Well, nobody did that, you know.
Right.
But Iacocca, with his foresight, you know, had knew, he had a mind's eye picture of this.
Can you tell me why Bordenay wouldn't have thought that? What was his mindset at the time?
Well, I don't think I would have thought of doing it to begin with, but if I had, I think Gene or anyone, you know, in his position would have thought, you know, what are you reaching back for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's old-fashioned. That's, mm-hmm. And I would have, too, if I were the vice president and someone else under me was doing this project, I would have said, that's not the way to go. What do you want to do that for? You know, it's dumb. It's backward. Well, I had one of my designers make a perspective front and rear end rendering of this car with these elements on it. And I had to admit, when I saw this, that it looked awfully good, very distinctive. And we started right away with this rendering to revise the front and rear end appearance of the car. We even added some front-end overhang to it, which is something engineers hate. They don't like weight out, hanging out over the front axle in order to give it this very long nose. Gene came back from Europe, and I told him what had happened. And he says, "Oh, God," or something like that. I said, "Well, now, wait a minute." I said, "It looks very good." I said, "It's very distinctive." And, well, he says, "I guess if Lee wants it that way, you got to do it." Something. I'm not quoting him directly, but this was sort of the way the conversation went. I said, "You know, come back to the studio and have a look at it. I think it looks very good. It's very distinctive." So he did, and he did. He thought it was great, you know. But neither one of us would have done it on our own, I'm sure. I have to give Lee credit for that. So Lee came in due course of time, and he saw it, and just like that, he said, "That's it. That's it.
Really?
That's it." He said, "That is it." Well, I guess in a way, I wouldn't say he had to say that, but it's, you know, it's his ideas. He must think they look good, and they did. Of course, we had to execute it and so forth.
Which is no mean feat.
No, it was diverse design elements, but they worked all right. So it went, it got tuned up some more, and feasibility studies made, initial ones anyway, to make sure that the interchangeability had been preserved with the Thunderbird. We used the Thunderbird roof panel and windshield entirely, but we raised the, what we call the lower back, or the upper back panel, the part of the body that's directly behind the back window. We raised that 2 inches higher than a comparable body panel on a Thunderbird, and that made the roof look lower. It was swallowed up more in the body of the car and gave it a more hunched look, which we thought was a pretty good design ploy. So anyway, it got tuned up, and it went to the, oh, by the way, I want to dwell a little bit on the name. I had a habit of naming projects just so I knew what I was talking about, and other people did too.
Personal code names.
Mm-hmm. I called it, first of all, I called it Merlin, which I thought was a rather clever amalgamation of Mercury and Lincoln.
And famous Arthurian magician.
Yes, and the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine and so forth.
Right.
And it's a smooth-sounding name.
Yeah.
It's a slick name.
Flows off the tongue.
The Lincoln Mercury Division people, who didn't want this car at all, by the way.
Oh, really?
Oh, they didn't want that car. Now, I don't know.
Who was opposing you at this time? Who in the Lincoln Mercury Division?
Well, they couldn't really oppose me.
No,
because,
but I mean,
well,
private.
I don't know. They're some of their product planning people.
Oh,
and I guess the vice president, I forget who he was.
Who
at
was
the time.
That time?
I don't know.
Ben Mills still around?
I don't think it was Ben. It was probably someone else.
Yeah.
But anyway, in general, the Lincoln Mercury Division did not want this car at all. But it was sort of being shoved down their throats.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got it, of course, it tasted very sweet because the money poured in like it wouldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, some in the division thought, you know, if we're going to have this car, that's a slick name. And others didn't. Anyway, it went by the wayside eventually, and I rechristened it Lancelot.
Hey.
Again, sticking with the Arthurian legend.
Right, yeah.
And if you're familiar with the, I'll show you some photographs when we get through talking, so you'll know what I am talking about.
Okay.
If you're familiar with the design of the Continental hood ornament, which originated with the Mark II Continental, it's sort of a, it's not a rectangle exactly, it's got bowed sides and it's got a cross motif in it.
Mm-hmm.
What I did, I designed this myself, by the way. I kept the general outline of the bowed rectangle, but coming up through the middle of it was a sword.
Yeah.
Yes, with the point sticking out of the top.
Mm-hmm.
And this looked really neat, and it went with the Lancelot name. However, there were those, Ralph Nader amongst them, and his word was being taken fairly seriously, who thought that an upstanding hood ornament by itself was bad business, but one with a sword point coming through was even worse. I wish I had kept a handmade model of that thing because it was kind of neat, and I'll show you pictures of it. It, as I recall, it went to the product planning committee with a modified hood ornament on it, you know, just with the Continental Star as we know it now. But I think it still had the name Lancelot on it at the product planning committee meeting at which it was approved.
No eyebrows raised about the name?
I think it was pointed out to them, probably by Iacocca, that the name was a temporary one and it was not at all finalized. They should, you know, approve the car, you know, and we'll thrash out the name later. It was one of the few times that I saw Henry Ford actually excited and almost ecstatically so about a new model. He knew, of course, he was looking at a clay model, but he said, and I was there, so I heard it, he said, I'd like to drive that home tonight. And I'd never heard him, you know, so enthusiastic about a car. I think they authorized $40 million for its engineering and production. A lot at the time, but nothing now. You know, he's talking billions now.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't that much. Anyway, it was enough. And the next thing that happened was the chief engineer of the Lincoln Mercury Division, Bert Andren, came in the studio one day. He said, well, he says, you know, you got to take 4 inches off the front end. I said, what for? He says, too much overhang. I says, I'm not going to do it. Well, he says, you have to do it.
Now, overhang is what?
The amount of car, body, whatever you want to call it, that overhangs the front axle.
Okay.
In other words, if you look at the side view of a car and the front wheel, center of that is the axle. If you have 15 inches of car, including bumper and everything sticking out, you got a 15-inch front overhang.
Why would body engineers be unhappy with that?
He's not the body engineer, he's a car engineer.
Oh, the car engineer.
Body engineers don't give a damn. Okay. All they do is, you know, draw the thing up and stamp it out. They're not concerned about it. It's the guy who is the car engineer, who's really the designer of the guts of the car.
Okay.
The chassis is responsible for how the car performs, how it rides, how it handles, and so forth.
Right.
And of course you don't want to overload the front end of the car, but this is mostly air. It was done really, you know, to give a long nose.
The Rolls-Royce touch.
Well, yeah, if you want to call it that, although this is certainly longer than a Rolls-Royce, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a standoff, you know. And he wasn't my boss, and I wasn't his boss. And yet he was insistent that 4 inches had to come off, and I said, no way, I'm not going to take that off. I said, you should have spoken up several weeks ago. I said, this thing has been approved by the product planning committee, as is. And I'm not about to take 4 inches off of that. Well, he says, you got it. It's just too much overhang. So I went to Gene.
Well, forgive me. Yeah. Would he have thought that it was dangerous, or?
No, I think he was concerned about the weight.
Oh, the weight.
I don't know. Well, that would have been his first concern, was overloading the front end. You know, the weight, the distribution front to rear in a car is important. It has to do with the way the car rides and handles and so forth.
Would it have a tendency to dive on stops?
Yeah, right, something like that. You don't want to overload either end of the car, actually.
Yeah.
But, well, I went and I talked to Gene, and I said, now I've got an impasse here. Bert wants to take 4 inches off. He insists on taking 4 inches off the front end, and I told him we won't do it. And he says, that's right, we won't do it. Now, I never heard anything more about it. I gather Bordenay had a consultation or a conversation either with Bert himself or with Bert's boss, who would have been a vice president of engineering.
Would that have been Herbert Nish at that time?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Could have been.
Andren is spelled A-N-D-R-E-N.
A-N-D-R-E-N. A real good guy, really.
Uh-huh.
And a nice guy to work with, but then he probably felt he was doing the right thing. The only thing was, he was out of joint time-wise. Mm-hmm. He should have made this comment much earlier, and then we could have negotiated it, maybe. But as it turned out, the 4 inches stayed on, and I guess between Iacocca and the Lincoln Mercury Division, they decided to abjure the mark numbers on a series of Continentals that were Lincoln derivatives in the 60s.
Now that would have been the mark
three, four,
and five.
Yeah,
58, 59, and 60.
Those.
Right. Yeah. Which were phony marks.
Phony marks.
Yeah, right, yeah.
They were Lincoln derivatives. You know, different gimmicks on them. So the Iacocca, as he's wont to do, just decided to abjure them. You know,
rewrite history.
Yeah,
forget about
right,
that.
Right, they're not there.
Right.
And dubbed this the Mark III.
Not a bad idea.
Right.
Considering
takes guts to do, in a way.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's what happened. Yeah. So it became a Mark III. Mm-hmm. And it went into production, and it was just a huge success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you get proper credit throughout the company and the industry for this?
Yes, I did. And the first credit I got was, you see, I was, at that time, I was on the E role, which is the executive role, and I, at that level, I am assigned company cars twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
Not always of my choice, but always luxury cars.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Mark III, when it went into production, the use of it as an E car was restricted to vice presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wrote a letter to Bordenay, stating that when the Mark II was went into production, its chief stylist, John Reinhardt, was assigned a Mark II as a company car, even though he did not have vice presidential status. And I said, with that precedent in mind, might it not be appropriate that an exception could be made to this rule? Gene said, I'll give it a try. Why not? What the hell? So, I don't know. I guess he talked to Lee, and I suppose Lee said, yeah, what the hell? You know, the guy did a good job. Anyway, the next thing I got was a phone call from somebody at the executive garage and said, Mr. Ash, has been an exception made to the lease car, the e-car program as regards to Mark III, and I'll order one if you like. So I did.
Oh.
Much to the surprise and consternation of my colleagues when this showed up. That's about the only time I ever tried to pull anything like that, but it did work.
Deserved.
I was quite pleased with that. Well, I guess that was the last real major thing that happened in my career. The Mark III went on several more years with several modifications.
They were minor.
Most of minor, yeah.
They knew a good thing when they had one.
Huh? Yeah. Well, the investment was pretty well paid for, and it was just, you know, making money,
sure.
Pure money.
Mm-hmm.
And Bunky Knudsen came in somewhere along there.
How did that impinge on your area?
Well, not terribly much. I kind of liked the guy in a way. He was I liked him in that he was a pure automobile man. He was kind of like Iacocca in a way, very different, but I mean, he was not a what we call a bean counter,
mm-hmm.
an accountant or a product planner. He was a real bona fide automobile man,
uh-huh.
grease under his fingernail type guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was the son of
Simon.
This was Simeon.
Yeah, Simon. Simon.
Simon. The son of course, of the original Knudsen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But from GM, he quit. And, yeah, of course, Bunky left General Motors.
Right.
Because he didn't make him president. Well, Henry drove out one dark and stormy night and hired him, which was not a very good thing to do when you got people like Iacocca standing around twiddling their thumbs.
It was very odd that, although Iacocca tries to explain it in this book, it's very odd that that Ford at this time, about 1969,
I guess so.
Decided that he wanted the GM look again, apparently.
I don't know. Yeah. Bugge, of course, immediately brought in a couple of guys from GM Styling.
Who were they?
Dave Wheeler was one, and the other was a Japanese-American chap whose name I don't recall at the moment.
Larry Shinoda.
Larry Shinoda.
S-H-I-N-O-D-A, yeah.
Wheeler is still there, although I think he's retired. He got demoted immediately after Bugge left. Shinoda got fired.
Wheeler is still with the company.
I think so, yeah. He wasn't a terribly effective person, but Shinoda was a real crackerjack designer, and I liked the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he rubbed an awful lot of people in the wrong way, including Gene, who was his boss.
He had
no respect for Gene at all. You know, he said, don't bug me, man, or I'll tell a man, in effect. You know, he relied entirely on Knudsen to stand behind him. Of course,
that must
Gene,
have really galled the Bordenay.
Boy, did it gall him. Well, the day Bunky was fired, Larry Shinoda was in Germany, I think, attending the Frankfurt Auto Show. Gene called him and he said, you better get back here right away because as of today, you're not on a company expense account. And he says, you're fired. That was that.
What's the story about somebody put up a sun that was no longer rising, that was somehow sinking into the sea?
I don't know.
Did you ever hear that story?
I don't recall that,
yeah.
No.
Well, elaborate a bit on Shinoda, since you're one of the few people who liked him and thought he was good.
Well, I liked him as a person and as a designer.
Yeah.
I got along with him because he had no axe to grind with me.
Yeah.
We were heavily into stock car racing then, the Ford Motor Company was, and I worked with Larry a number of times modifying certain elements of the stock cars so they'd go faster.
Yeah.
And we just got along very well, you know, kindred designers.
Mm-hmm.
I was aware of his personality and his tendency to flaunt his big daddy.
Mm-hmm. Relationship with Knudsen.
But as far as I was concerned, he never bothered me in any way. Mm-hmm. He had no axe to grind with me or anything like that.
And you felt he had a lot of talent?
Very talented, oh yes, very, very talented. Right, but he sure didn't know anything about company politics, or he sure didn't seem to know who his boss was, his real boss.
Well, I guess he was the impetus, was he not, behind Knudsen's penchant for taking the Mustang and turning it into what later became the boss and other other manifestations.
Yeah, right.
You got some observations on that?
Well,
period.
As I recall, the Mustang at that time when Knudsen came in had a phony air intake on the rear quarter panel.
Uh-huh.
And this Knudsen didn't like it all, and he had Shinoda redesign the rear quarter panel with it eliminated. I don't think it improved the car at all, but the developing of other elements of the boss were mainly colors and stripes on the outside. Okay. The rest of it was purely mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
Big wheels and tires and an enormous engine all hooked up so that it would... I know I had one at one time when they first came out, and I didn't keep it very long because it was such an awful car. Well, it would, you know, it would throw you back just with the slightest touch of the accelerator. It was so overpowered. And I lived in a area where my driveway went uphill before I reached the street. Now, there was the least bit of slickness on that. I could not get up with that car because it would just spin its wheels.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you'd go over the end of the garage.
Well, I kind of wanted a field. When the Bucky came in, the Mark III was already going, but for some economy reasons at the outset, cooling economy reasons, it had Lincoln wheel covers on it. And Bucky didn't like that at all. He said it's got to have its own wheel covers because that's very important. Now, I certainly thought so too, because those are an important element of the car, what the wheels look like. So my executive designer that was working with me at the time, Art Querfeld.
Q-U-E-R-F-E-L-D.
Yeah. Right. Of the funeral home here in Dearborn, and brother runs that. Yeah. Art's retired now. Yeah. Very talented.
Was he?
Obstreperous, cranky type guy, but
but talented.
But good too. Yeah, but funny. Anyway, we having gotten this assignment, we thought, what can we do that will complement the classic look of this car? Classic being the front end mainly, and the rear end. So we went over.